Welcome to the NCO Journal podcast. This is a podcast series where we discuss published articles with authors and provide a forum for the open exchange of ideas, information, and solutions. I'm your host, Staff Sergeant Brandon Cox, the NCOIC of the NCO Journal, and with us is Chago Zapata, the managing editor. Today we discuss the article, Addressing Unsustainable Op Tempo, by Sergeant Major Andrew Gregory, the 4th Infantry Division Sustainment Brigade Support Operations Sergeant Major. Sergeant Major, could you please tell us a bit about yourself?
So, Sergeant Major Andrew Gregory, currently is support operations for 4th DSB here in beautiful Fort Carson, Colorado. Thanks for having me, guys. I appreciate it.
Yeah, Sergeant Major, thank you for joining us. So your article is Addressing Unsustainable Op Tempo. Can you kind of give us a description of what op tempo is in your own words?
So I think it's important to delineate, and it's something that came about through the height of, you know, the global wear and terror, where op tempo was really defined as deployments. You know, when you left CONUS, you came back and you did your reset and all that. But as, you know, the last 20 plus years has really grown the requirements for the Army globally, op tempo has really taken on a shape of a myriad of different types of events. So we've continue to deploy to CENTCOM. We have rotations to Europe. We have rotations to INDOPACOM. And we also have the exercises that happen both in UCOM and INDOPACOM as well as in the States. And then most recently, you see the border surge in line with POTUS and SECDEF requirements, unforecasted requirements that may pop off around the world. And all of those really formulate the whole picture of what the operational tempo is for the Army.
So you do say, Sergeant Major, in your article that the current op tempo is potentially detrimentally affecting the force. Can you describe what you mean by that?
The current op tempo, in all fairness, this was written before the border surge had taken off. But we'll give Fort Carson as an example. They have currently, we have 4 brigades, two, and then including the sustainment brigade. 1st Brigade is currently on a career rotation. The sustainment brigade is getting ready to go to CENTCOM. The aviation brigade is getting ready to go to CENTCOM. We have 2nd Brigade at the border. So realistically, just brigade-wide, the footprint on Fort Carson is severely diminished. And you've got soldiers that are potentially coming off of a rotation that are getting slated to go against a different requirement, or someone that just came from a CENTCOM deployment that is PCSing into Fort Carson and they're getting ready to go on an exercise or an NTC rotation or some other CTC rotation. That doesn't really allow for a individual, whether the service member is married or not, to mentally and physically reset their lives so they can give their best foot forward to the Army and the nation.
One of the questions that I came up with while I was reading your article too, Sergeant Major, is that there's a lot of activity, I guess, going on by different units. I'm sure that there's different commands, different units in the Army where their op tempo is much higher because of maybe their mission or maybe because of leadership. What are some of the things that the senior NCOs could do from their perspective or from their end to get to the point where maybe some of, instead of maybe the quantity of deployments or training rotations or whatever the case may be, are maybe not as high and it's more about quality rather than quantity?
I think that's really a two-parter. At echelon appropriately, senior leaders can engage training plans, who's doing what and manning requirements for, you know, you've got your installation task versus your deployment or rotation prep. And it requires really the engaged leadership at the appropriate echelon to work those processes. Something as simple as a well-thought-out and well-executed sponsorship program gives soldiers predictability about what they're going into so that an individual and a family don't just show up to an installation and then a couple weeks later they're on a plane somewhere, unannounced, if you will, because no one thought through the processes of, while, yes, we're sponsoring this person to this organization, we need to go ahead and give them some predictability about what they're walking into. And here are the tools as far as getting families situated. Here's our housing situation. Here's how childcare works on the installation, spousal employment. All of those can be integrated into a proper sponsorship program that provides predictability for the service member and their family members. Now, as far as training pipelines, personal example was I was in 4th SFAB here at Fort Carson, did a rotation to Georgia and Macedonia, was selected to go to the Sergeant Major's Academy about 3 months after I redeployed, came out of the academy, came to Fort Carson, was automatically given the heads up that we were deploying to CENTCOM at a date. So just those little things of how do we integrate PCS cycles, the train up for that, how do we alleviate the unnecessary requirements while also giving some time back to those individuals. Best lays out how to be less detrimental to the soldier so that they can put their best foot forward.
Is that why you were inspired to write this article, Sergeant Major? Was it based on that specific experience, like what you said about going to the Sergeant Major Academy and then going to your next duty station and immediately, you know, having to step out again?
So I think my inspiration was 20 years of war. I invaded Iraq in 2003, and I'm getting ready to embark on my 7th overseas tour, my 6th combat tour. And while the older generation of us are a little more indoctrinated, if you will, with the on and off cycle of deployments or rotations, the younger generations aren't necessarily on board with that, but they just aren't familiar with that. And that unknown, I have seen a large spike over the years of the mental preparedness of what it takes to be willing to give yourself repeatedly to the nation's call of what the Army asks of you. And it's really come through social media pages, at the installations where I've been stationed. And a lot of it comes through the spouses are unprepared, just given the fluidness, if you will, it's probably a bad word, fluidness of how the process goes. And they're left asking questions. They're left unprepared. And for the individuals that will be, have spouses and have children, the soldier has their own concerns, but if their house isn't taken care of, if their families aren't prepared, if their families don't feel supported, that's going to have the second, third order effects that really negate the experience the soldiers could have in theater. And then that lessens readiness, that lessens the ability to have a mission accomplishment. And it really doesn't allow the soldiers to perform in length for their tours as well as they could have. And that's really, I have my own personal experiences with that, but that's something I've seen probably a large spike within the last 5 to 6 years.
That's interesting. I mean, I have my own experiences too as well, Sergeant Major. I didn't invade Iraq, but I've been in Fort Bragg at the line unit, and I was on GRF and doing SRP every 3 months and going to JRTC 2 or 3 times a year, because even with that, even if you don't deploy from that unit, you're still constantly getting ready, training, retraining, certifying, validating, and then when you come back, you recover and you put it all back in the box and you get ready to go do it again. So that is stressful of itself. And generally, I find that you mentioned that families are very unprepared with how to accept this information and change their lives on a dime for this, because they don't really fully understand. I think it's because the soldier doesn't even really understand. They're just taking orders as it comes. And I think that is a problem that we can maybe try to help. Do you have something for that, Sergeant Major?
And 100%. And that goes back to, you know, everything is a leadership problem, right? How you mentally prepare your soldiers coming into the organization, especially the junior soldiers coming straight out of the BCT, AIT land. They don't know anything about the Army. They don't know what a training progression looks like, you know, through a CTC and onward to a deployment. They don't understand that you're going to do, you know, 45 days and, you know, it's NTC and you're going to come home and you're going to reset. That's going to require you to be away from home. That's going to require additional hours. And then you're going to go into additional pre-deployment training, pre-deployment outloads, stuff like that. All that, you know, they're just unfamiliar with. So it should be incumbent upon the senior leaders of the organization to best work out not just a training and deployment timeline, but rather how do you put that on paper? How do you relay that information down to the lowest level so that you understand that the lowest person in that formation not only has that information, understands what that takes, and then being open for feedback and questions and sometimes criticism of what that all entails and why we're doing what we're doing and how we're doing it. You know, just simply shooting out an email of like, here's the, you know, here's the next 6 weeks. That lowest individual, one, may never get it. So what do you do to create a feedback loop to ensure that that's happened? But then how do you create the feedback loop to understand that that information is digested, not just by the service member, but also if there's a family or a child involved?
Like you said, it's about leadership and being involved. Staying on top of things and knowing your people.
Your people is always the battle, right? Like that's what you should be doing. Yep.
Yeah, but that creates difficulties at different levels. You know, when you're a young a sergeant and you have a squad, you know, you only have a limited number of people. But if you're, say, the platoon sergeant or the first sergeant, then, you know, you're limited as to what you know, how much you can learn about all the people who work for you. So there's always going to be challenges, but let's talk about the one of the things that you mentioned here, and we talked about it before the conversation here that we're having now, and that was the regionally aligned readiness and modernization model. Can you tell us what that is? I know that you talked about it in your article, but you didn't really delve too deep into what it was. I'm curious as to what relevance that has to the subject matter.
So the rearm model really, you know, the readiness modernization model, it enables the units to align capabilities to the regions they're going to. It addresses the Army's ability for maintaining readiness with the soldier and the organization aligned to their mission requirements. But it also enables the Army to modernize. And it's supposed to balance demands with the readiness of the organization and the formation. You know, I give you the Google answer when I was looking up for the article is it aims to create a more predictable, flexible Army capable of supporting the nation's defense strategy. The unforecasted requirements that I talked about earlier have kind of strayed that model away. We do our best to still manage that. But I think we don't take into account rather the personal aspect of that. In my experience, I have seen white space as the enemy. Some call that a unit training management problem. Some call it an op-tempo problem. Some call it a leadership problem. You should be able to have white space in the rearm model to where people can deflate the Army from their life, not necessarily separate it, but be able to set aside some time to just be with their families, be with their soldier, you know, be with their friends, and not necessarily have to worry about what's coming next, if that makes sense.
It does. And I get the, you know, the repetition, because you get reps, you get better, you practice it, you know, you're a better fighter. But there's that point. He's like you said, the white space in the training calendar is the enemy, and that seems like that's an old Armyism, right? I don't know. I know that that's still very prevalent in today's. And I was wondering, do you see any issues with the current just sheer number of requirements that the Army places on its units to stay ready? And should that be looked at?
So I'll speak to the sustainment enterprise because line units are, I'm sorry, infantry units, combat arms units, you know, they have their individual requirements, but the sustainment enterprise has the individual requirements within those formations, but then they're also out supporting those combat formations as well. So when you're looking at an organization that has to focus on their own deployment processes, timelines, and individuals, they're also still supporting the combat units with, you know, HET support, or HR platoons are out doing personnel actions for the combat formations. You have ammo companies that are still doing ASP operations. So it's, there's a balance of where's the white space when we still have to support the maneuver formations and take care of ourselves and make sure that we're the best ready organization to go forward and do our mission. I think that larger echelons just need to be more cognizant of maybe turning off the garrison local support in order for that for that's the same formation to really focus on their downward or downrange mission so that they can be best prepared for what they're going to encounter in whatever theater they're going on to.
I see what you're saying. I'll give you a quick, I have an aviation perspective that I think might aid. So it was always extremely difficult for us because I feel like in the training calendar, there wasn't time placed for maintenance. I mean, just general, you know, unscheduled maintenance. And I was an airframe sheet metal guy. I was back shops. So if any of the aviation guys are out there, don't get mad at me. But
you were riveting.
Right. I was extremely riveting.
Solid dad joke. Solid.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I feel like they put so much pressure on us because let's say we'd go to gunnery, right? We'd have to get validated. Our pilots had to get their hours and their shot time. Okay, but they never – I feel like they never understood that, like, there will be two aircraft that are going to be broken after gunnery. And they're like, okay, well, we are going to JRTC in 3 weeks after that. And it's like, okay, well, we need 8 aircraft. And it's like, okay, well, we only have 7. And it's like, well, how do we get it when done? And, you know, their answer was always, we'll make the guys work Saturday, Sunday because they were unable to keep these up. And it's like, well, if you wouldn't have put gunnery 2 weeks before JRTC, then we wouldn't have this problem in the first place. Meanwhile, you know, we're packing containers, we're blocking and bracing, we're doing inspections, we're making sure we have all the tools required. Like, there's all this other stuff that happens in between these main events that they don't actually put on the calendar. And if they did, they would see that, like, oh, well, it takes 8 hours to do this and it takes 3 days to do this. And I feel like that is a problem.
Well, you're not even talking about white space. You're talking about actual space, but
right.
It's like
that requires white
with
space
other stuff. Yeah.
To yep. Complete
like the brain major to reset.
Right.
Right. The major movement of rail loading maybe, right, and it's aviation, you guys get to cheat a little bit, right, because you get the, you know, the pilots fly their airframes and they kind of cheat the system a little bit. The ABCTs and the strikers, you know, rail loading's on the calendar, but what might not necessarily be on the calendar is the tips and scales, the maintenance checks, the pre-stage at the railhead, right, the support activities for shelter, feeding, you know, transportation to and from the railhead. Like, all that stuff might not necessarily be delineated on the training calendar. So they just see Monday we start rail load.
Right.
But realistically, there's 96 hours to the left that is taking people away potentially for the entirety of, you know, extended hours. And then, you know, maintainers always bear the brunt because just as you pointed out, right? We need all of this stuff up. And the go-to answer is, well, we'll nix PT, we'll have them work on weekends. And how do you translate that to a training calendar, or mitigate it completely by even getting further left of it so that people have some downtime before they're out the door?
Exactly.
Let me dive in after that, though. You're talking about there's a lot of things happening. So where what are the solutions for something like this? Because it doesn't seem like there's no cure all for you know, certain things, especially in the Army when there's the mission and there's so many things to the left and the right that need to be done beforehand, and there's very little time for that white space that allows, you know, soldiers to reset. Allows them to connect with their families, allows them to do things that are, like you said, away from the Army. So what is the solution? You talked about that in your article. So let's dive into that a little bit. What would you say about that, Sergeant Major?
So I think that's the role of the Sergeant Major, 100%. While I understand that you're never going to have 100% solution, and things are going to occur that are just going to pop up, right? Things are going to happen. But I think that's where the sergeant major, with the time and service and the experience, sits in those meetings, sits in those you know, in progress reviews, sits in the planning meetings, and itemizes those requirements and ensures that they get on the training calendar and that they're distributed and they're discussed, right? Hand waving the pre-staging of vehicles and equipment at the rail yard. Like, that might just be talked about, but actually ensuring that it is laid out, scheduled, and depicted on the training pipeline, that is important. Asking the hard questions that if we're going to do this, as a sergeant major, being able to look at your battle buddy and saying, if we do this, what does it mean for A? What does it mean for B? What does it mean for C? And out of those, you know, we'll say three categories, right? Soldiers resetting and spending time with individuals outside of work should be a conversation, and putting it back on the commander as the commander to either write that risk and accept that risk or mitigate it by coming up with different options to, you know, not necessarily appease one or the other, but to find a blend that can facilitate a little bit of both.
So it always leads back to leadership and being aware. I guess as a sergeant major, you're a battalion or whatever, a regimental command sergeant major, whatever the case may be. It's up to you to advise and keep the troops in mind, right? So I know that one of the things that when Sergeant Cox and I were talking and he told me that it's not always the case where sergeant major. He or she might be just like saying, yes, we can do that, make that happen, without considering maybe some of the other ramifications of that as to how it might affect the soldiers on a personal level, mental level, that sort of thing. So I think it's important that that's why it's important that we have conversations like this for those who are listening. That they need to think about the overall picture and not just mission. There's also the people who make that mission happen. If you don't take care of them, then the mission may not happen.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, in the article, I talked about alternative leaves. And I didn't really know how to phrase it. But we're traditionally, you get there's leave periods per se, right? Like in these 2 weeks, everyone's going to go on leave. But that doesn't always work for individuals. Prime example is my pre-deployment block leave window didn't align with my children's school year. And my wife happens to be a school teacher in the same district. So I opted to not take pre-deployment leave for the entirety of it because I was just going to sit home by myself with my dog. And to me, that would have been a waste of cured leave. So maybe expanding, instead of a 2 week block leave window, there's a 30 day block window that allows soldiers to pick time frames that are more appropriate for them to maximize that time with their families and with their friends, you know, that allows them better flexibility if they want to take a vacation somewhere or they want to go, you know, out of state to see their parents and their parents' schedules don't necessarily align with that strict 2-week window. So that's a possibility. I've been in organizations where that was a thing, specifically around the holidays. And it worked out great. It required a little more manpower and accountability rather than just everyone's on leave in these 2 weeks. So it required a little bit more work, but the end state was that people really got to experience and enjoy a true reset prior to going into missions and downrange.
That kind of leads to one of the sections that you covered on your article, which was retention. And overall, according to the TRADOC and you know the Army and analytics that they've provided in the past or recently here, retention is not really a problem in the Army. But I think that there's kind of a fallacy to that, because if you have your little piece of the pie, your world, whether it's in sustainment or in your line company or whatever the case may be, you see a snapshot of what's going on around you, and a lot of good people might be leaving because of that op tempo that you talked about. And they're leaving and you're getting, you know, the noobs, and they're showing up and that continuity, that base of experience, the hard earned experience is gone. And because of these kind of things that are happening with the op tempo. So I would say, you know, retention maybe overall might not be a problem, but when it comes to being in a place where you're losing good people mm-hmm. who are making the choice right. not to stay.
100%. And so you retention at the big Army levels, I'll make this assumption that it's a metric, right? The Army just met its recruiting goal a few months ahead of schedule, which is awesome. But the nuance of why those numbers are being met are important. And the same goes for retention. Is the economy bad and people are just choosing to stay? Here at Fort Carson, we have great installation retention, and it's because Fort Carson is an awesome, awesome installation with a great surrounding area, and people love to be at Fort Carson. So I don't ever see retention ever being a problem at Fort Carson, regardless of what's going on. But the nuance of as the seniors, the staff sergeants, of why they're being retained or choosing not to be retained is important. And you're right, I do see a snapshot of the installation at my time here. But over the course of my career, there have been several soldiers. Their reason is I'm burnt out. I can't do it again, or I need a break. And if you look at just, you know, we have 100% of retention, cool, we did it, and good job, Army. But the ones that weren't retained or chose not to be retained, it's important to look at those and understand why a senior staff sergeant is choosing to get out, or why a junior officer is choosing to refrat. Like, those nuances are very important to understanding the health of the organization and where people's heads are at.
Yeah. I think that, as a, I guess, senior staff sergeant, as the one you were just phrasing to, I already re-enlisted, so I'm in. You got me, Sergeant Major. I'm here.
Indefinitely.
But that decision was extremely difficult for me, because I didn't make it just based on myself and my experiences. I had to make it for my family. And I can't tell you that every unit I was in and every situation I was in was the best thing for my family.
Fort Drum.
Yeah, drunk, Brad. I did them all.
So it's funny those places are mentioned, right? Like, they just come to mind as high op tempo environments.
Yep.
They just have an association with, if you are here, you're going to put in the work. Like, you're going to row the boat and do the things.
Yes.
because that is what we do here.
And I hate to phrase it that way, but I mean, when I was in Germany, yeah, we worked all the time. We did a lot of stuff. I probably got most of my learning and experience through there. But for whatever reason, when I got to the CONUS stations, the big ones, they just did things the same, but more. And I don't know how to say that that's worse. I don't think that it's worse. I just think that it's different. And I don't know why we don't have one standard throughout the entire Army, because it seemed like when I was overseas and we did all the things that we needed to do, there was just more somehow that we had to get done. And there was like a different type of, it was just a different type of environment.
Right. There's this, that, you know, I can't put my finger on it, but it's just different. Mm-hmm. Is 100% true. I was in Germany from 2018 to 2021. And my organization at the time, we had the only heads in Europe, and we were supporting Eastern Germany. We were supporting inside Germany. All the rotational forces came through Grafenwehr, and we were offloading, you know, the track vehicles. And the op tempo there was busy. My entire company was together for 2 weeks out of that entire time. Mm-hmm. And it was just different coming back to CONUS, to ForceCom, and seeing we're all doing things. It's just got a different flavor to it here. And I agree. I don't know why we can't standardize, because the Army is all about systems and processes and standardization, of why we can't standardize how that all is supposed to be laid out and worked.
I would say that it's culture. It's a cultural thing. You go to Germany, there's a certain culture. You come here, CONUS. If you go to Bragg, or like using Stasser and Cox's two places that he's been, Bragg and Drum, they're going to each have a different culture. And then the people who, as they leave, whether it's commanders, whoever, they leave us that culture, whoever steps into that seat, picks up that same culture and continues on, because if it's not broken, why fix it, right? But there's times, yeah, that it's not about breaking it, but about making it better. And I would hazard to say that it's not about quantity, but about quality. And maybe that's something that you know, for us and where we are at in our seats that we are right now, is that we can talk about the fact that NCOs, the people that we're reaching out to, that you consider these things, especially as you progress through the ranks. You know, if you're more of a junior NCO, when you get to that level where you're a command sergeant major or sergeant major and you're advising your commander, then it's up to you to kind of keep these things in mind, because of things that you learn and things like, and the conversations like what we're having right now.
Right. And I think part of that change of improving, some has already happened. You know, General Beagle in 10th Mountain implemented, I think he was the first one to implement the no cell phone policy after, I believe it was 1800 and before 05. We have implemented that, not we, CG General Doyle has that policy here at Fort Carson as well. It's policy's letter 11. And I am a giant fan of it, because I have been in those organizations where the group chats and the text messages and the late night phone calls are just constant churning. Your phone's always going off. And it's something that I harp on my individuals about, is being proactive with communication. That way, I know it only seems like a few hours, right? 1800 to hopefully people are going to bed at like 2200. But those few hours of no work does a lot for the mental health for soldiers to reset and buy back some of that time with them, with themselves. Those type of situations, or those type of policies, do help start the culture change. But it only becomes true culture change, is like you said, when the next individual comes in and continues that and enforces that. Because changes in time aren't necessarily impactful unless they're carried out for a long duration of time, and it just becomes the way, right? It's no longer, oh, this is a new policy or this new procedure. It is the right way. It is the way we do things. And that's how you really do long-term change.
Yeah. And I was there when that policy went into effect at Drum, by the way. It was Sergeant Major Terranus and General Bugle. But, yeah, I remember Sergeant Major Terranus coming to the brigade, and he was like, yeah, I mean, if you guys have to contact your soldiers after 1800, then, like, what are you doing? Like, you didn't plan enough during the day that you couldn't tell them where PT was going to be tomorrow? And then that was their biggest thing, was like, well, what if it changes? And they're like, well, then you go with the first plan. Like, it was
So, you know, being prior cell phone era in the Army, mm-hmm. Soldiers have asked, like, what did you do? Like, how did you, like, we put out right. information. You put out information and you stuck with the plan. There were no digital leashes to yank and pull and make changes to the last minute. Like, that was the plan for the day, and that's what you were executing. And they seem bewildered that we would just, here's your plan, go execute. If things go awry, you know, you report back to your chain of command appropriately. And it's something that I've tried to work with here and inside my SPO is the night prior, if it doesn't, you know, it aligns with policy letter 11, if it doesn't directly impact 0630 formation, it does not happen in a group chat after 1800.
Excellent.
And it's and it happened a couple days ago, to be honest with you guys. It was like 1805, and an NCO put something into the group chat that was just like a general information sharing an Army Times article. And I just immediately just, hey guys, policy letter 11. And it just stopped, right? There was no additional conversations, because I'm sure you guys are in group chats where once a piece of information goes out that it's, you know, 4, 5, 6 replies, your phone's going off and you're just like, what is going on? Right. So then you're forced to look at it to understand what the situation is. That has been an easy win for the soldiers. They understand that if we're contacting you after 1800, there's a reason why, but they've come to expect that would only be for emergency situations. If it affects the 09 work call, we will deal with that at PT formation. No big deal.
Yeah. Back in my day, we had a morning formation, word was passed. And if anything happened at the end of the day, you didn't hear about it unless everybody had there was a phone roster. If you're an NCO or a staff NCO in the Marine Corps, then you had a phone roster and then you call people, you know, and very rarely did that ever have anything have to happen like that. We made things happen without a cell phone with no problem, and things were working just fine. But it's just, you know, with technology, every time new technology comes out, there's always, I guess it creates a whole new set of problems.
There's a learning curve, right? Yeah. How to wield those tools appropriately, right? Just how senior leaders just, you know, they should learn to wield their powers appropriately. The tools that help us achieve those outcomes that we want, like, they got to be leveraged appropriately. Technology is a great thing. We've seen, you know, great advancements in everything from group chats that used to not be a thing to, you know, people using AI and stuff these days. It's just how you leverage those tools to better the organization and, more importantly, better the soldiers that you're in charge of and how you care for them.
Sure. I think I have a good question that falls right along with policy 11 and all of this work-life balance. That is, to me, that is one of the main things that, you know, it was a part of my decision to stay in, for one, and then for two, like, you know, where I'm going next in the market, things like that, PCS options. That's like one of the main things I think about is work-life balance. So you guys already have the initiative for policy 11, you know, for the no cell phone rule, but are there any other things that you either are currently doing to help this work-life balance and help the families and the op-tempo stress? Or is there anything you want to see happen?
So I think work-life balance in the Army, not that it's a fallacy, but, you know, General McConville put out his one slider of major events versus major Army events and stuff. I think it's important to understand the Army's always going to get its time, right? It's always going to... it's always going to come first because it's the Army. And I think how leaders should get after that is unpredictability, right? Training schedules, training progressions, even day-to-day operations, right? Those things should be predictable. And then from a senior leader's position, being the example of taking time to take care of yourself and your family. If they always see the commander or the first sergeant or the sergeant major in his office or her office till 2000 at night, they're going to feel compelled to stay in that AO. Be like, well, if they're here, I should be here. Show them that, hey, my son has a band concert at 1600 on Thursday. I am going to go to that. Right. You should also invest in your family as much as you're investing in the Army. Now, that doesn't mean, to include myself, I get to just say, hey, I'm out. I'm going. I'm going to go do this thing and drop everything that I'm doing. It requires communication and planning. So for the juniors that are listening, you should be able to, you know, a week or two out, if not longer, like, hey, I have this, you know, a family event coming up. I would like to attend it, and it's middle of the workday. There should be, in my personal and professional opinion, there should be little to no reason with that amount of lead time that service member cannot attend that event, right? It's on the calendar. You know where that individual is going to be. Let them build that family capital so that they can be the best for the organization later down the road. All of my events for my family are on the calendar. My calendar is open to everybody, and I put out of office, I am going to concert A or sports team, you know, game B, so that they see that it's okay to step away. But it's, you have to communicate that with your leadership so that everyone has an understanding of what's going on.
I think that brings up a good point that ultimately that I think commanders and the senior enlisted, their advisors, the senior enlisted advisors are, you know, remember and keep in mind is that doing things like this and they pay dividends in the end. You know, it makes for a more prepared force in the long run, you know, morale, not just for the soldier, but for the families as well. Without a support group, and you mentioned that in your article, without a good support group or no, a soldier, it's gonna break. It's like a tool, you know, right? It'll break. You stretch it too far, you don't take care of it. You don't give it the attention that it needs, the maintenance that it needs. The tool will break, and then you'll have somebody who's just kind of being more of a burden rather than a help.
Right, a soldier's well-being really. We'll use the married soldier template, right? It's really a house. Right. You've got your army wall, you've got your family wall, and the roof's holding it all, to, you know, kind of being a structure, you know, holding them up together. If one of those walls isn't sound and isn't strongly built on a good foundation, that house isn't going to exist for much longer. If you look at a single soldier, right, their social life with their friends outside the army, maybe they like doing automotive stuff or like hiking, that's their other wall. If we're not doing our best as leaders in the organization to help solidify that wall, that house isn't going to be there, and we're going to lose that soldier, and it's going to hurt the organization.
Oh, one last thing. I just wanted to, on a similar note, when I was, by the way, I was part of that 2003 invasion force myself. I was with the 11th Marine Expeditionary Unit at the time, on our next deployment in 2004, I was in the JOF, and we were in combat operations starting from August 6th for about a month and a half, something like that. And it was like, talk about op tempo. You know, I was PAO. We were part of a 5-man shop. And I worked 18-hour days. There were days where I went and sat down outside the headquarters and you know, sat on we had a, it was a hard building, and I sat on some stairs, and I decided, oh, I'm just gonna sit back and just close my eyes for a second, And then, you know, 2 hours later, you know, somebody woke me up. So it's, I think it's important, you know, depending, there's going to be times where the operational tempo is what it is. But I think that one, my problem and my, at the time I worked for a captain, is our problem was that we didn't prioritize our well-being. You know, I could have, we could have done a little bit of a like a handoff, right? Where there was a certain amount of hours we each worked, and then when my captain wasn't working, I would take over, and so on and so forth. We didn't have that. So a lot of it, I think, has to do with planning. There's going to be times where the operational tempo is what it is, and you have to deal with it, and you have to make time, you personally, as a soldier, to prioritize certain things. And if you don't, in the long run, you're going to be, you know, falling asleep on the stairs.
And, you know, you don't make a, if it's not a priority to you as the individual, I'm not going to know it's a priority as a leader, right? If that's something that's very important to you, you should be able to vocalize that it's a priority to you. And that gives me the cue as the leader to, you know, hey, if you need, if your, you know, your son's band is your, that's your priority, then I understand that when those things do arise, right, I can do that handoff and say, go handle that. I've got everything. If you're in theater, 100%, right, the, no, not necessarily in theater, but just in general, the operational tempo does require long things, long hours, you know, a hard mission. And it's, again, it falls back to the leader to prioritize that. Because if you've done everything right as a leader, that soldier will work for you, will go above and beyond, extended hours, harsh conditions. And you've got to be able to be cognizant of the fact that you need to sometimes pull back. And it is better if it's done proactively rather than retroactively, because you don't know the impact that can have on that individual if you don't pull back in time.
Thank you, Sergeant Major, for joining us, and a thank you to our audience. Remember to put your knowledge to the page, submit articles, and get published with the NCO Journal. Don't forget to check out our webpage and follow us on social media. We'll catch you next time on the NCO Journal podcast.